This week on Vox Talks, what can the economics profession do to fix its implicit bias against women? Welcome to Vox Talks from the Centre for Economic Policy Research. My name is Tim Phillips. Women are substantially underrepresented in economics. They face barriers to entry and professional success that are higher even than those in other STEM subjects. The research and other professional contributions are systematically undervalued. Now, even if this treatment of female economists is accidental, it's an accident that's been happening for decades, and the statistics on gender bias are not improving. A new book from the CEPR examines the role and progress of women in professional economics, reviews the barriers that women face, evaluates programs to support and encourage female economists, and discusses the benefits of greater gender equality across the profession. In a Vox Talk special today, I'm speaking with Shelley Lundberg of the University of California, Santa Barbara, who is the editor of this book, and some of the contributors about their research, about implicit bias, and about what can be done. So I started by asking Shelley, how did economics get into this mess?
There is no direct evidence that answers the question, how did we get here in economics? And one of the patterns that comes out is how distinctive economics is, even with respect to sort of STEM fields and other math-intensive fields. Economics itself is sort of seen as an unwelcoming discipline, both unwelcoming and perhaps limited in the way it can be applied to human problems.
One of the chapters in the book investigates the history of the profession's male bias over the last 50 years. It finds that the assumptions that many economists make may have led to this implicit bias.
The chapter by Cléo Chassonnerie-Zégouche, Beatrice Cherrier, and John Singleton, they're talking about the history of the AEA's Committee on the Status of Women, and in particular, the events surrounding its establishment in the early 1970s. And the theme that they pick out is that in the dispute over what should be done with women in economics in the early 1970s, should they receive preferential treatment, should we be focusing on the status of women in economics at all, economists' views of how to think about that were connected with their views of how labor markets work. Right? So the key thing here is that the position of women in economics is closely related to the kinds of things that we as economists study, how markets operate. What we see there is that the conservative economists, Milton Friedman, George Stigler, are saying, the markets existing are fine. You know, if there aren't women in economics, it must mean that they either don't want to or they're not very good. And so we should just let markets proceed. Economists fundamentally don't understand implicit bias. And they think that, hey, I'm a good guy. I'm not really biased. I don't dislike women. I don't have a problem with women economists. And that means that they ignore at a fundamental professional level the evidence that implicit bias is operating. And the word implicit suggests that you're probably not noticing that it's going on.
But more recently, as many economists begin to call out this bias, surely the situation must be getting better. Shelley Lundberg and Jenna Stearns of UC Davis have contributed a chapter to the book that evaluates the most important indicators, and it concludes in the title of the chapter that there is stalled progress.
And so I think one thing that we've discovered over the last several years is that most economists, male and female, thought that the position of women in economics was continuing to improve. Right. In the 1970s and 1980s, there was a very sharp increase in the representation of women in economics graduate programs, among economics faculty, and so on. And I think the stalling out that's occurred over the last 15 or 20 years really flew under the radar. We provide all the evidence that is in the chapters in this book that actually there is true bias, all right? We can provide rigorous empirical evidence that women in economics are not treated the same way as men, even given their productivity. And I think with the awareness of that implicit bias, I think then we can start doing something about bias in tenure decisions, bias in long-term assessment of people's research worth, and so on.
Even if overall progress has stalled, one of the most successful ways to help individual women thrive in the economics profession has been mentoring. Donna Ginter writes a chapter in the book about her experience of running a mentoring program called the Cement Workshop that follows the AEA meeting. From its origins in 2004, its 50 places for each workshop were always oversubscribed, meaning that a combination of the six cement cohorts, with those that applied but could not take part, doubles up as a randomized controlled trial of the effectiveness of mentoring on the careers of the mentees.
We had lots of people applying, and we were able to keep the conference a certain size and randomly assign people to the treatment, which was the two-day mentoring workshop, and the control, which was no workshop or no information. And during the workshop, we have one-hour sessions where people bring a paper, and then everybody else in the group, two mentors and the other mentees, give comments on that paper in order to improve it. And interspersed between these one-hour sessions are breakout sessions where the senior mentors get up and talk about things like work-life balance, getting tenure, publishing, getting grants, networking, and those types of things, sort of suggestions for how to manage your career among those different dimensions. We do actually have enough data to follow these people over time. If we look from 2004 to 2018, we have about 650 people. Our analysis looked at a little over 300 people. So we're able to tell that women who receive the treatment actually published more papers, published more in Econometrica, Quarterly Journal of Economics, the American Economic Review, and the Review of Economic Studies, and were more likely to get grants, and were more likely to get tenure in the top 50 economics departments worldwide.
But while the success of the program has been remarkable, it's still not clear exactly why it has been so successful.
We attribute the success to the workshop. We're not exactly sure what aspect of the workshop is instrumental, so we don't necessarily know the mechanism. I have another paper with a graduate student where we show that women who attended the workshop have larger co-authorship networks, and these networks are not necessarily with other women at the workshop. So it could be that the information provided at the CMET workshop actually promotes women to think more broadly about their careers and invest more carefully in how they do economics going forward. When we first came out with a paper in 2010, which was an interim evaluation, the results were huge. So we've had a bit of regression to the mean. But yeah, the impact is very significant, very telling. So it's surprising and positive. And it's hard to believe that 2 days of thoughtful, intensive information on one's career can change careers.
Another way in which we know that female economists have received different treatment is at the early stages of their careers, when they're trying to get permanent jobs in top universities. Jenna Stearns and her co-authors contribute a chapter about their paper that shows how a well-intentioned policy to help women achieve job security in academia has not only failed, but completely backfired and produced the opposite effect to what the policy intended.
Most assistant professors are on the tenure track, which means they're appointed to temporary or probationary contracts, which typically last up to about 6 or 7 years. At the end of that probationary period, the assistant professor will go up for tenure, where they're evaluated based on their productivity, their teaching, and their service to the university, so they gain security of employment after that. If they don't get tenure, then the contract is terminated and they need to find a new job somewhere else. So in research universities in the US, tenure is primarily based on research productivity, both on the quantity and quality of research output and publications. And this disadvantages women in particular, because this time at which they're evaluated for tenure and they go up for tenure often corresponds with their prime childbearing years. The problem with this is that having a child is a very large productivity shock for new parents, particularly women who bear the burden of being pregnant. It's very physically difficult giving birth. And then also caring for a newborn infant is very time consuming and requires the mother to breastfeed. New parents are often sleep deprived. Someone has to stay home with the infant when it's not in care with someone else. And so this all constitutes that new parents are generally less productive than they would be without having a new baby at home.
So in the US, this historical unfairness led to a change in policy, by which both new mothers and new fathers who were on the tenure track had their time limit extended.
So universities in the U.S. have started to adopt what are called tenure clock stopping policies to help deal with this issue that the tenure clock system may systematically disadvantage new parents, and in particular women. The tenure clock stopping policies essentially grant new parents an extra year on the tenure clock per child, usually up to two, meaning that they can go up for tenure a year later than they otherwise would have, and therefore have a full extra year to try and produce research and get that research published.
And so what happened next? Well, not at all what the policymakers intended. The new mothers spent much more time parenting than new fathers. And so on average, the fathers could use this extra time to produce more or better work, while the clock really did stop for new mothers, who were much more likely to be busy taking care of their children.
We find that when universities implement these gender-neutral tenure clock-stopping policies, tenure rates for women actually decline and tenure rates for men increase. This has two important implications. One, tenure rates for women actually go down compared to tenure rates for women prior to the introduction of the policies. And two, these policies actually increase the gender gap in tenure rates, which is exactly of the opposite of what they were primarily intended to do.
The problem with well-intentioned gender-neutral policies like this, Shelley Lundberg explains, is they often don't have a gender-neutral impact.
And what's going on behind this? Well, what's going on behind this is that tenure committees are treating two very different career events. On average, becoming a father while you're on the tenure track and becoming a mother while you're on the tenure track are actually not events that have equal impacts on your productivity. This is on average, right? There's certainly fathers who take a big hit given their parental activities, but tenure committees aren't taking that into account. And so what does one do about that? I think it's very difficult to come up with a standard policy solution to it. I think it is going to be a matter of, once again, awareness. Economists in this position realizing that they are attempting to make a judgment about someone's long-term career, and that they should be making those judgments conditional on what they know the person has been facing and what their research environment has been like for the last restricted number of years when they're on the tenure track. We know people can do that for chronic illness, for men and women, but they don't do it for parenthood, the different sort of sets of family responsibilities that men and women make.
This research suggests that we need to be very careful when designing gender-neutral policies, because these policies may have very important unintended consequences. Certainly, some people don't believe our results or find it difficult to believe that these mechanisms are plausible, but I would say overall, the most people seem to have personal experiences that align with the results that we find.
Another fascinating piece of research into the implicit biases in the economics profession was done by Erin Hengel of Liverpool University. In her working paper, Publishing While Female, she revealed that in peer review, women are on average held to a higher standard. She was inspired to do the research, she says, when she started teaching, and it seemed that her male colleagues were often less able to express themselves clearly. But to her, it seemed that unclear writing and speaking was tolerated more in male than in female teachers. This led her to calculate the readability statistics for decades of published economics papers.
I thought, oh, well, maybe there are different standards here. Maybe the women have to be clear. You know, for people to actually like think that you're doing a good job, maybe as a woman, you have to make your explanations much clearer. So that was where I had the first idea. It just kind of kept going around in the back of my head, and I kept thinking about it. And one day I was like, how can I test this? And I thought of lots of different ways to test it. And then I thought, well, maybe I'll just see about readability. I downloaded the data, I cleaned it, I applied the tests, and I was like, oh, yeah, maybe this is a thing. And so one of the reasons why I did it was because I thought it was all in my head. I thought, well, this is just you being oversensitive. Well, why don't we just collect the data and see if you are? I took the abstracts of every article that has been published in the top four economics journals since 1950, and then I classified their authors by the gender, and then I estimated the gender gap in readability. I find it's between 1 and 6%. The next thing I thought, well, okay, is it because they just already are more readable papers, Or is it because they're actually being demanded to become more readable in the peer review process? So then the next step I did was I found a draft version of a paper and I compared it to the publication version. 40% of the gender readability gap is actually formed in peer review.
So what can the profession do to start closing these gender gaps and eliminate these biases? Well, Jenna Stearns and first Donna Ginter believe that the profession is missing out on undergraduate talent and has a culture that is often off-putting, even for those women who persist.
We need more majors at the undergraduate level. There aren't as many women interested in majoring in economics as undergraduates, and that's a pipeline issue that we need to pay attention to. Claudia Golden has a program to try to increase women's undergraduate majors in economics, and I think we need to increase the number of women who are potentially interested in getting a PhD in economics. I think that's really important.
Anecdotal evidence suggests that women may choose to sort into environments based on early experience with toxic environments that men may not care so much about or may be less likely to experience. So thinking about ways where we can remove opportunities for harassment in economics, inappropriate behavior, more conducive collegial environments during seminars, conferences, etc., may go a long way to getting women to enter into the profession and persist into the profession. I think this is important not only for representation overall, but because the demographic characteristics of economists affect what we teach and what we study. And it's important for undergraduate students to be exposed to a diverse set of mentors and teachers that are going to bring to the table, both in terms of teaching and research, topics that are interesting to the students and topics that are important for shaping future economic policy.
Meanwhile, Erin Hengel's got a more direct wish.
I want them to publish more women. It's that easy. I really don't understand why they don't publish more women. It baffles me.
So is the profession's bias blind spot only a problem of fairness that affects female economists? Or does it have wider consequences? Well, Donna Ginter thinks so.
As we think about the diversity of the economics profession, I think it's really clear that women and people from underrepresented groups ask different questions. So if we don't have a lot of women, if we don't have underrepresented minorities, the questions that affect those sectors of the economy may not get asked and may be overlooked to the extent that we don't understand what exactly is going on. So I think the economics profession and our knowledge of what's happening in the economy suffers if we do not have a set of diverse voices looking at these issues.
And so the final word to our editor, Shelley Lundberg, who's been fighting this fight for her entire career. Does she think that economics is harming itself with its implicit bias?
Well, it's a very good question. What does economics miss out on if women don't pursue? Let me point towards a fairly recent paper in the Journal of Economic Perspectives by Amanda Bayer and Cece Rouse that attacks exactly this question. And I think there's a number of different dimensions. One is, in economics specifically, we've seen surveys that show that on average, male and female economists have different policy views. And so I think recommendations for government policy, regulations, redistributive policies, and so on will be systematically different if we have more women in the profession. Secondly, departments and agencies and central banks will operate differently if the economists in them are more diverse. It is pretty clear that the perspective one takes to various economic problems is informed by your background and your experiences. So I could probably point to work of my own that wouldn't have happened if I were not a woman. And finally, we need a diverse economics so that we can inspire all of our students, so that all of our students, poor and rich, male and female, white and minority, can see themselves in the economists who teach them and mentor them and imagine themselves an economist as well. It's part of the job we do, and I think we'll do it better when there are more women in economics.
Thank you to Shelley, Donna, Jenna, and Erin, and to all the other authors who have contributed to the book. It's a free download from voxeu.org, and the title is Women in Economics. Editor Shelley Lundberg. This has been a Vox Talk from the Center for Economic Policy Research. Remember to subscribe for our weekly podcast and check out the archive at voxeu.org/vox-talks.